There were 23 senators who voted against authorizing President Bush to take us to war in Iraq. My guest, Lincoln Chafee, was the only Republican. He also voted against the president's tax cuts. Two examples of how this senator from Rhode Island was at odds with the Bush White House and got the reputation of being the most liberal Republican senator of the Bush years. He was also a member of the so-called Gang of 14, seven Democrats and seven Republicans who reached a compromise on how to deal with filibusters of President Bush's judicial nominees. Now Chafee has written a memoir called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. Chafee was the mayor of Warwick and planning a run for the Senate to take over the seat of his retiring father, John Chafee, when John Chafee died in 1999. The governor appointed Lincoln Chafee to take over his father's position. He won the election in 2000. In 2006, he lost to his Democratic opponent, Sheldon Whitehouse. Chafee is now teaching at Brown University. Lincoln Chafee, welcome to Fresh Air. In your book, you write that in the decades before 1994, this is before the Republicans swept Congress, before the so-called Republican Revolution, there were 24 moderate Republican senators who would meet for lunch in the Capitol every Wednesday to build camaraderie and talk about how they would work together in the week to come. But you say by the time you got to the Senate in 1999, only five Republicans were willing to be seen at the moderates' table. Why was that?
Yes, originally my father, who had preceded me in the Senate, was part of a much larger moderate Republican group stretching across the country. Nancy Kassenbaum from Kansas, for instance, and Alan Simpson from Wyoming. And by the time I got there, it had shrunk to the five, two Maine senators, Snow and Collins. Jeffords was still a Republican from Vermont, Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, myself. And as the South turned from conservative Democrats to conservative Republicans, the agenda of the Republican Party switched to conservative, dictated from these Southern senators. And I saw it in my lifetime, a solid Democratic South, slowly, year by year, turned to almost solidly Republican. Very, very conservative, just as they were as Democrats, but now they're Republicans. And they set the agenda for the Republican Party.
You write in your book that nothing in Congress could pass without moderate support if the moderates stuck together. But, you say, the administration had a plan for making sure the moderates did not stick together. What is the plan that you're referring to?
Well, that's my theory, that the tax cut was very premeditated. That tax cut of the spring of 01, a $1.6 trillion tax cut. And to put it in perspective, President Clinton had vetoed in October, so just several months earlier, a $400 billion tax cut. And Clinton, in his veto message, said it's irresponsible, it jeopardizes the surplus. This is $400 billion. And now here we were debating a $1.6 trillion tax cut. And my theory is that every politician, of course, likes to vote to cut taxes. There's nothing more popular than cutting taxes if you're a politician. And so the administration was serving up this almost irresistible temptation in order to get Congress on their side. And I saw my fellow moderates peel away, one by one, support this $1.6 trillion tax cut. I was left alone in opposition. And that broke our moderate coalition right off the bat. It was very premeditated, in my view.
So you think that one of the purposes of proposing the tax cut early on in the Bush administration was to break the moderates as a unified group?
Yes, and also to, as I say, neuter Congress, that show that the executive branch is going to run the show. And the first order of business is the most popular thing you can do is tax cuts. And one by one, they rolled over. The chairman of the Finance Committee, Senator Grassley from Iowa, initially said he opposed it. He fell in line. And so it worked to perfection, as we now know.
You write in your book about your first meeting with Vice President Cheney, and this was right after the election, and he met with you and the other four members of the moderate Republicans who met weekly with each other. Tell us what that meeting was like.
Yes, this was the day after the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Bush-Cheney after the long recount of Florida, December of 2000. And Senator Specter had invited him to join us. And when I read the news that the Supreme Court had ruled that night, I thought, oh, he'll have better things to do than meet with us. But he kept the appointment. And we met in Senator Specter's Capitol office. And it was just the six of us, the vice president and the five moderate senators. And I was shocked that, and there's a cliche, you almost fell off your chair. I almost fell off my chair at that lunch as he outlined this divisive agenda. And it's big tax cuts, it's getting out of international agreements. And to me, this is contrary to what you ran on, is what I'm thinking. You said, I'm a uniter, not a divider. And now you're going to enact this divisive agenda. Governor Bush, the candidate, had said, when Jim Lehrer in the debates asked him, what kind of foreign policy are you going to have? Fair question to ask the candidate for President of the United States. And the candidate, Governor Bush, had said, we're going to have a humble foreign policy. If they're arrogant, they'll resent it. And at the time, I was cheering that, saying that's the kind of candidate I want. And here at this lunch with the vice president, just hours after the Supreme Court has ruled, he's saying the opposite. We're going to have an arrogant foreign policy. We're going to be divisive. And two things struck me. Number one, how quickly they were going back on their campaign pledges. And secondly, how can the vice president have the confidence, the vice president, to outline this agenda just hours after the Supreme Court has ruled? To me, that said that the vice president's going to be a very, very powerful figure in this administration. He's speaking just these hours after the Supreme Court has ruled about this very, very different agenda from what was part of the campaign rhetoric. And at that lunch, I saw my fellow moderates not pushing back on this agenda, and that gave me a sinking feeling that we wouldn't have this key five-block vote, which would be so fun to exercise the power. I mean, it was so rare and fortuitous, if you will, that it's a 50-50 Senate. We have the power, these five moderate senators. And I saw at that lunch us not exercising that cohesiveness we needed to at that lunch.
What did you say? Did you do anything to exercise your power?
I was the junior member, and we go by seniority. That's the way the Senate works, even at an informal lunch. So when my turn came, if you will, I was saying, you're going to need our votes. And the vice president just didn't seem to. He said, we'll get the votes. Every vote's important, if I recall, was his comment. And in other words, I'm not going to kowtow to this group. That was the message.
How much direct contact did you have with President Bush?
Well, right after the tax cut, I did vote against it, and I expected to be the only Republican to vote against the tax cut. As it turned out, John McCain surprised everybody by voting against the tax cut in the spring of 2001. And I felt, well, I'm going to disagree with my party, my president here. This is unfortunate. We're getting off to a bad start. Let me meet with him one-on-one. And the White House accepted that, and I went down to the Oval Office. And I came out of that meeting more rattled than I went in. It was just the two of us, President Bush and myself, and I came kind of to say, I know there's going to be issues we're going to disagree with, but where can we find common ground? And I said, this agenda is going to jeopardize Republican seats in the 2002 elections, which are coming up. We just got wiped out in 2000, went from a good majority to a 50-50 Senate in 2002. And he just didn't want to talk about it. He said, don't you worry about what we're going to do. And I came out of that meeting very rattled and concerned about the leadership of the country at that time, which served me well when they started talking about Saddam Hussein being a threat and other things. I was on my guard, and it served me well.
You know, in writing about your meeting with President Bush, you describe how you brought up the issue of abortion, and you brought the name of Laura Bush into the discussion. Tell us what you said.
Well, as a case in point, that they're going back on the campaign promises, if you're a uniter, not a divider, I mean, over and over again, I can remember that phrase in the campaign. The president, the first act after he was sworn in as in inauguration, very first act was abortion, taking on an abortion. And however you might feel about it, there's no denying it's a divisive and a highly emotional issue. And so if you're going to be a uniter, it's the last issue you'd want to take on, not the first. And so at the meeting, the two of us in the Oval Office, I said, why are we getting into this abortion issue? It's so divisive. People feel so strongly about it. It's very, very emotional. And I said, even Laura, your wife is pro-choice. And he snapped at me. You keep my wife out of this, he said. I remember it. And that ended that conversation. On to the next.
Is Laura Bush pro-choice?
Yes, I'd seen in an article somewhere, and as I sat there at the meeting, I was scratching my head to think, am I accurate on that? Do I recall that article accurately? And I did go back afterwards and find it, and she had said something to that effect. And he didn't deny it. He didn't say, no, she isn't. He said, you leave my wife out of this.
One of the important votes that you write about in your book is the vote in Congress authorizing the president to take us to war. And you're still angry at how that was handled in Congress. You're angry that it was rushed through. Tell us, from your perspective in the Senate at the time, how it was rushed through.
Well, angry is just one of my feelings. As we look at 4,000 dead, and we're arguing whether it's $2 trillion or $3 trillion or $4 trillion in the cost. And worst of all, if there is something worst of all in this whole debacle, is that there's no good way out. There's just no good way out now. And so angry is just one of the ways I feel. And the big issue is that we didn't have a true discussion about what the administration really wanted to do there. They were dialing up the fear, and that certainly sold well after September 11th. Saddam Hussein's a threat. He has weapons of mass destruction. That was the mood at the time. And so the vote was being taken place in October of 2002, which is the midterm elections are just weeks away in November. And so it was all caught up in the politics at the same time. And after Jeffords had switched across the aisle, the Democrats had the majority, and the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Levin from Michigan, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, the most important committee, I would think, on this issue, was urging us to slow it down. And he had an amendment just hours before the war authorization just to slow it down. And that was defeated by almost the same vote as the war resolution was approved. It was a terrible performance by Congress.
You write that you think Republicans and Democrats remain entrenched at the political extremes.
Yes.
Examples of that?
Well, after the 2006 elections, in which I lost, DeWine from Ohio lost, Santorum from Pennsylvania lost, Burns from Montana lost, Talent from Missouri lost, Allen from Virginia, I think I have them all, six of us lost, all incumbents. And as we know, incumbents have a huge advantage. The first thing we did after that wipeout, we met to elect our leadership, and Lamar Alexander was running for the whip position. He's not a liberal by any means, but a different voice in our leadership in the Republican Senate, and he was defeated by one vote by Senator Lott, who was making a comeback. And I said to myself, we're not changing. Let's have one different voice in our leadership of our Senate. There's four or five members of our leadership, which we vote for, and that said we're not changing. We're stuck in our partisan trenches.
How do you think the Democrats remain entrenched in a political extreme?
Well, they've been more ineffective in standing up to this radical agenda, and that's my criticism. Even in the last September, there was a vote to declare the Iranian guards as a terrorist organization. Again, to me, just giving the Bush-Cheney administration tickets to commence hostilities against Iran. And that was a huge vote, 70 to 25 or something. And the Democrats just can't stand up to this administration. That's what I've seen.
My guest is Lincoln Chafee, former Republican senator from Rhode Island, whose new memoir is called Against the Tide. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lincoln Chafee, the former Republican senator from Rhode Island, and he served from 1999 to 2006. He was considered the most liberal Republican in the Senate during his tenure. He's written a new memoir called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. In your book, you referred to when the Black Congressional Caucus, just after the contested election of 2000, asked for a senator, any senator, to object to the way the results were handled. And no senator was willing to do it. It seems like you're sorry that you didn't do it yourself. Is that right? Like, if you had it to do over again, you would have stood up and contested the election?
Oh, that was very, very memorable. And since most elections don't involve such razor-thin margins and 5-4 Supreme Court decisions, this was very unique. And as we learned about this arcane electoral college process, one of these constitutional provisions is that one member of the Congress can stand up and ask a senator to object, and that sets in motion a chain of events. Not necessarily changing the election, but at least it sets in motion some chains of events. And the members of the Black Caucus, we were meeting in the House of Representatives as Vice President Gore counted the electoral ballots, which would lead to his loss. And the members of the Black Caucus were standing up saying, begging any senator, Republican or Democrat, to object. And I think all of us thought that that we've put this behind us, we're going to move on. We've got a uniter, not a divider. We've got a humble foreign policy. The candidates had pledged to regulate carbon dioxide, so they'll have an environmental program. If we had known that they were going to go back on all these pledges and how radical they'd be, certainly I would have raised my hand and set in motion that chain of constitutional events.
Do you feel like Gore set a tone that he didn't want anybody to object?
Yes, yes. He had conceded, and he did set that tone. You're absolutely right. As I sat there, he was willing to move on.
The last time we spoke, a couple of years ago, you said that you lost your seat to a Democrat in the Senate, but you were glad that the Democrats had the majority now in the Senate. Do you still stand by that? And how effectively, from your point of view, do you think they used their majority?
Yes, I do think it was important that there be the proper questions asked. Have I been disappointed that more of these proper questions haven't been asked of the executive branch? Yes, but at least it hasn't been a complete all the committee chairs being of the same party and no questions being asked. That has changed, and I think that's good for democracy and good for America at this time in our history after this administration, which no one can deny has been very, very radical in their agenda.
Am I right in saying that when you were running for re-election in 2006, when you were defeated, that John McCain supported you?
Yes, I was in a very much a no-win position of making the decision to look after Rhode Island, my state, and knowing there were some very, very important bills coming up as I contemplated running in 2006. I knew exactly what I was in for. This was the Rhode Islanders would be mad at the Republican agenda. They're not going to be happy with President Bush, and he and Cheney were not going to be on the ballot. I would in 2006. And so I made the decision to run as a Republican and look after my state as best I could. And as such, I had to attract those Republicans in which I shared some points of view, and certainly with Senator McCain and the environment and the Gang of 14, I had some commonalities.
So after John McCain supported you in 2006 for your reelection, is it awkward for you now to not be supporting him?
Yes, but that's part of politics. And once I lost the election in 2006, it gave me some freedom to think about my future. And the war is the big issue. I mean, that he and I agree on the environmental issues, and he was the leader in the Gang of 14, but the war trumps everything else. And he's still insisting that was a good move. And as I said earlier, it's the cost in so many ways, and the lack of options. It was a terrible decision.
You lost your election in 2006, and you've been teaching at Brown University. People say I don't know if you've made it official, but that you're considering a run for governor of Rhode Island in 2010. But you're an independent now. You know, a lot of people thought you'd switch to Democrat because you'd been so isolated as a Republican and so liberal compared to the rest of your party. How come you decided to leave your party and become an independent?
I guess lines of liberalism and conservatism cross somewhere, and you've said several times in the course of the interview, the most liberal Republican, which I'm proud to be called, but on some of the issues, fiscal issues, I consider that conservative to protect our surpluses, and I do consider it conservative to look after our environment. I think that's long-range conservative thinking to make sure we have clean air and clean water, and not getting involved in these foreign entanglements, to me, and Pat Buchanan would agree with me, now, that's conservative. And when I decided to leave the Republican Party, particularly after that vote I talked about where my Senate leadership wasn't going to change after losing those six incumbents, me included. And it took me about 6 months to think about it. And here in Rhode Island, we call it unaffiliated. So I'm an unaffiliated voter. And assessing the future, it gives me a chance. But I did want to not be a Republican anymore. And what I saw, the fact that they weren't changing.
Lincoln Chafee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me on your great show.
Lincoln Chafee is a former Republican senator from Rhode Island. He's currently a visiting fellow at Brown University. His memoir is called Against the Tide. I'm Terry Gross.